My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I said they are admiring my brick up there. It's been there forever. And I'm one of the older bricks around here, I guess. Although there is a guy up there in 69, but... And Keith and Sue Drum have a prettier sign than anybody. They shouldn't even have one. But anyway, there's something nice about being old. I was talking to someone at the break who I just saw at the Las Vegas convention. And I said something there that about being old. I might as well say it again. I'm one of the few people that you will ever know who sat and chatted with Bill Wilson for a while. There, you can't do that anymore because he's dead. But in 1963, I was sober 5 years, and I was on my job. I was sent to New York to get some signatures on proxies for various things, and I did that the first day, and I whipped it off. And so the next day I got up, what did I do today? I went over to the World Service Office to see Bill Wilson. They just had the International Convention in Long Beach in 1960, and I heard that. So I went over there, and I said, I want to see Bill Wilson. The girl said, well, he's booked up every hour by hour for the next 2 weeks, but maybe I can get you in 3 weeks if you like. I said, no, I won't be here. So I went over to the archives, and I was looking through some old pictures and old letters from Dr. Bob and things like that. And all of a sudden, here comes Bill Wilson. He said, are you the young man who wanted to talk to me? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, my 11 o'clock didn't show up. Come on in. So we sat down and talked for an hour in his office. And you know what he said? I don't remember. I was more concerned with what he thought about me than what he was saying. But I had, that's one of my two big moments. The other moment was in 1960 at the International Convention, Sister Ignatia talked, the only time she ever talked at the convention. And she talked about the day where Bill and Dr. Bob called her to see if they had somebody in the hospital that they could come and talk to. And she told it very well, and I really had heard about it so many times. And I galloped up afterwards, and I shook her hand, and I kissed her on the cheek. And I said, that was really a great talk, Sister Ignatia. And I suddenly thought, oh, but wait a minute. Are you supposed to kiss a nun? Especially if you're not a Catholic. So I said, I hope I didn't offend you, Sister Ignatia. Is it all right to kiss a nun? And I think she said, is it almost 60 years ago? It's hard to remember. I think she said, as long as you don't get in the habit. I can't remember every detail 60 years ago, for Christ's sake. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, and I enjoyed your talk very much. I told her at the break that years ago I used to play pool with a girl who looked like her, and I tried to give her some money back. And the worst thing is, she would have taken it. But it's a funny thing. I've been sober a long time, and I've been active and involved all a long time. And so I've been done a lot of places, a lot of talking around the world and so on. And it's an amazing thing, because each of us come here feeling we are uniquely different. But if there was a slogan for a newcomer alcoholic, it would be, but you don't understand. And one of the main things is I've come to learn over the years that the main problems in AA is the same problem I had and all the people around me had. I never really thought I was an alcoholic. Not really. Maybe I drink too much. Maybe I don't take care of myself very well. But I'm not an alcoholic. Because alcoholics to me were just old, gaunt people, long black coats who drank and went to jail. And I wasn't like that. I had a wife and children, and I had a trying to make it in the world. And I had ambition and grit and pluck, I thought. And in 1950, I got out of college. Well, I was in college in 1950 because when I was 14, my mother and father got divorced. And I was in such a religious situation, I'd never heard of a divorce. So it really appalled me. And what I replaced my affection for them with was a strong patriotism. And I felt very bad. This was 1941. And the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And I immediately began worrying about that. And I determined to go over and kill Japanese if I could. And early in 1942, at the end of my sophomore year of high school, I told my mother I wanted to go to Superior, Wisconsin, and visit my aunt, and she packed my little bag and gave me some money and got a guy to give me a ride to Minneapolis so I could... I just learned how to hitchhike. I never tried it. I said, just put out your thumb and smile. And so that won't be bad. I got a ride to Minneapolis, and I stood outside of Minneapolis. I remember the highway, and... had a hard time. But I finally, some guy stopped. He said, where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco. I thought that's where you'd go to enlist. And he said, so am I. I'm in the Navy going back to a ship. Hop in. And he drove me all the way from Minneapolis to San Francisco. And we'd stop at night. There were no motels. But he'd give me a room in a trailer court or something, or a bed. And he bought my meals, and I didn't think about it. I mean, I look back and think, God, that really was remarkable that he would do that. But at that time, I thought, that's just what is when you hitchhike. You tell people where you ought to go, and they get you there. I told him I wanted to be over there and kill Japs. And get he said, well, you're a little... I was about this tall and had a face full of pimples and wore glasses. And he said, I don't think you quite look grown up enough to get in the Marine Corps like you want to do. And you can't get any service, I suppose. He said, but you might get into the merchant marine. They're just crying for people because all their good guys go to the Navy. And I'll let you in the Red Coast Guard office, and you go in there and tell me you want to be in the merchant marine. And that's all it takes. They'll give you some kind of application. Put down 16. Don't put down 14, as which we are. And we came to San Francisco, and I remember smelled the ocean for the first time, how just the way I dreamed it would be. And it was wonderful. We drove down Market Street, and he stopped at the Coast Guard office. He said, go in there, and I'll just tell him you want to be in the Merchant Marine. So I went in. I said, I want to be in the Merchant Marine. The guy said, fill out this application. He gave me an application. I put down 14 and there's 16. He said, well, you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And that afternoon, I was on a ship going to the South Pacific. And it really, I was dumber than you have to be. But on a ship with a bunch of tough old sailors, and they were all drunks and filthy mouth. And I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I didn't talk like that, and I don't drink whiskey. And remember, they all drank and sang dirty songs. And I'd avert my head and wonder if God was going to punish them. And just outside of Pearl Harbor, a guy came over to my bunk, and he put a bottle of whiskey in my face and said, here, have a little drunk, kid. Think you're man enough to have a little drink, kid? And I thought, I better stop this now. I was going to tell him, I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran, and we don't drink whiskey. We hardly ever even talk to people who do drink whiskey. And we're quite good people. I was going to tell him that. He said, why do you think you're man enough? And I heard a voice say, God damn right. So I had my first drink of whiskey, and I burned my mouth and my throat and my stomach and my throat and my mouth and his shirt finally. Get the bottle away, little son of a bitch. Ha 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 ha. And the next day they took me into Honolulu and got me a bottle of beer which I didn't like. You know, the reason I mention that is because so often in AA we hear about, I had that first drink, and it was wonderful. I hated it. We sailed around the Pacific. I never drank a drop. I wouldn't drink with those guys because I thought they were sinful, and besides, I hated it. And when I was 17, I went to the Navy. I was able to enlist in the Navy. And at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital outside of California, outside of San Francisco, being sewed together. And that's all there was to it. You know, they dropped the atomic bomb suddenly at the end of the war, and this Red Cross up there had shelves of tests they were supposed to give the soldiers and sailors as they came through. So I always been very good on tests because I read a lot. I remember the guy came in my office after I had taken the test. He said, "Clancy, this is strange, but you seem to be in the top 5% of intelligence of the entire United States Navy." And I said, "I know." But I got out of the Navy there in 1946, and I went back to Wisconsin, to my home. And, you know, I don't think anyone in here remembers 1946, but millions of people all got out of the service at once. They all went back to their hometowns or wherever they were and stood around on street corners and raised hell. And so what they tried to get them to do is go back to school. They had the GI Bill, which would help people pay for the GI Bill and so on your school. And I didn't want to go back to high school, be a junior in high school. And I was too slick for that. I went down to the VA and showed him my certificate I got as a base of that test. He said, "That's remarkable." He said, "I can get you in the University of Wisconsin." And he got me in the University of Wisconsin. And when I was in school, I noticed that after school every day, after college classes, the veterans all gathered together and went downtown, drank, and the good people went to the Luther League or some goddamn place. And so I didn't want to be with them, little high school snots. And so I went with the veterans, and I knew that I should really drink because that's what veterans did. So I really tried to learn to drink. I forced myself to drink and didn't like it, but eventually by my end of the first semester, I liked it. I guess I crossed an invisible line. I didn't see it all. And I was starting to really enjoy how it made me feel secure and stronger and older and wiser. And in college, I did very well. I was editor of the college newspaper, and I won some awards. I was on a national championship team, and I gave the talk at commencement on behalf of the senior class. And anyway, isn't that wonderful? And then we all shuffled across the stage and got our diplomas, and mine was blank, which I knew it was going to be, because I'd been taking an English history course at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I never could get up for it. I was just hung over too much. And so they gave me incomplete. And I had to go to summer school to get that. And I thought, God, that's really terrible. I've won a whole bunch of trophies for this college, this university. And I've been really a great student. And now they screw me around. I was supposed to go to work teaching in Duluth Denfeld High School in Duluth, Minnesota, teaching journalism. And I got to work at the U.S. Rubber Company at Ballast, white side, 1,600 white sidewall tires to a shift. And on the way home, I'd stop in a bar and drink heavily and get home drunk. And there was nobody home, so it was all right. And I tell everybody about how they screwed me. I said, you know, I did so much for that university, and they treated me like this. I'd tell that story to anybody. You know, they get so tired of hearing it. Don't tell us about that story anymore, Jesus. But one night I was in a bar, and this pretty girl came in. Nobody knew who she was. But I could tell by looking at her, she wanted to hear that story. So I told her a story for an hour and a half of how I'd been victimized. And she said, "That seems odd. You have your fingernails are dirty, and you're... your smudge on your face and your shirt is not clean." I said, "Well, I just came home from work. Don't you believe me? And I'll show you." We jumped her car and drove to the campus. Of course, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's all locked up. But But I found a door in the administration building that had just panes of glass. I took a rock and broke one of those and got in. I took up to the room on the second floor where the trophy case was, turned on the light, and a whole bunch of case of me holding trophies and smirking and laughing. And she was overcome. I could tell she slumped to the floor. I thought, oh my gosh, she's probably had a flat tire. So I tried to pump her up as best I could. And right then a policeman's flashlight illuminated us. If you ever want to try a perfect passion quencher, try a policeman's flashlight. What are you doing there? Nothing anymore. So we were arrested. Now I was arrested for breaking and entering in the nighttime, which is automatic 5 years in the Wisconsin State Penitentiary. I thought, oh, Jesus. But it turned out the school put in some clout and said, well, he's really not a criminal. He's an immature person, drinks too much. So they got it reduced to drunk and disorderly. But I remember sitting in that courtroom, so sick, and oh God, the judge was a friend of our family. He's going to come in and give me another one of the endless lectures I got. And I sat there, and a guy came into the box. He said, "Who's Evanson?" I said, "I am." He said, "Here, this for you." I looked inside, it was all my books, all my notebooks, and a little note on top saying, "I covered for you as long as I can, but I can't cover this one." It's signed by the dean. "You're expelled." So I was expelled after I graduated, for God's sake. You think that's funny? You'll never make it a secretary around here. You're supposed to sob at how sad it is. Oh, poor bastard. But I remember, then I got a telegram that afternoon from Duluth, Minnesota, saying that my job as teaching journalism had been canceled on the grounds of moral turpitude. And I thought, oh God, what a day. Then the judge finally came in, and he gave me that look. We've all gotten that look of how could you do this. He said, "Why do you do that, Clancy? Why do you act like that?" He said, I regret that you're that sorry." I said, "Why is that, Judge?" He says, "In my experience, people who are that sorry are not only sorry for what they've done, but they're sorry for what they're going to do." I said, "Oh, no, Judge, I've learned my lesson." But he was right, of course. And I got out of there, and I no longer had a job, no longer had a college education. I got a job in the newspaper as a sports writer, covering the Green Bay Packers, which was my favorite job I ever had in my life. And I met this girl with black hair and black eyes, just flashy. And all you ever meet in the Lutheran churches, blondes with blue eyes, they go, But she was deep, and I could see that she was deep, and she won my heart. And I finally proposed to her. She said, "Yes, I'll marry you." And I was so happy. But then she dropped a big one on me. She said, "I'm a Catholic." And, oh, God. Because at that time, Lutherans didn't marry Catholics in Wisconsin. You just stuck them with sharp sticks. But my love overcame my dismay, and we got married. And for about a few months, I had the best life I've ever had. I enjoyed the work I was doing writing for the Packers, and I enjoyed my home. Couldn't wait to get home. I'd gotten a bottle of gin and a bottle of vermouth, so I didn't have to pay $1.50 for martinis anymore. I could just make as much as I wanted until I collapsed on my table. And just wonderful. Happiest days of my life. And then my wife spoiled it. Her Catholicism. I'm not trying to be controversial, but she screwed my life up. I'll tell you how she did. She just started turning out babies one after another. I said, can't we use birth control? No. I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. Because here I'd been all over the world on ships and different places, and I only heard the word condom once in my life in a Navy training film where it showed this girl with big hooters and said, if you go to bed with her and don't wear a condom, you'll die. And I was, I'll take my chances. You know. But, you know, things were a lot different. You don't realize it. But all this took place in 1950. At that time, young guys or young girls or anybody didn't walk into drugstores and say, gay, give me some condoms. You find some older person who was depraved, and you'd and they'd get them to go and say things like, hey, give me some cigarettes and some rubbers. You know. Now look how much different, how much progress we've made. I live about a half a block from a drugstore on the west side, and guys come in, I guess they're kids, I guess they're grown up, they look like kids to me. They say things like, hey, I want to buy some condoms and some cigarettes, you know. But I got more children. I had to get some money going. So I got a job in a big company as a writer in an advertising department. And I started my career. I did that for years. I worked in places, and eventually, in a few months, they'd call me in and say, Clancy, you really write well. And I'd titter gently. Thank you. They'd say, but we can't have you. We need you on Mondays as well as the other days of the week. And when you come in on Tuesday, you smell bad. And so somebody told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I could use that to throw off the scent. I said, well, you're right, Mr. Carlson. I got drinking overseas when I saw that horror. People like to hear that, you know. And I'll go to this thing called AA, and I'll come back in a couple of weeks, and I'll be cured, and I'll get my job back. He said, fine, we'll keep your pay going. So I was at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in fall of 1950. 8 guys sitting around a table, just ugly old pukes, you know, talking about how much they lost and how much they drank and how much pain they'd had. And I thought, Jesus, what a bunch of losers these guys are. I got to get out of here. But a couple of days of that, I realized they couldn't possibly help me. But I had to pretend to be interested. And I realized I get another job. That job, I guess, is not going to work out. So I got a job in an adjoining state, Illinois, in an advertising agency. And I worked there and I did very well till the day came. About 6 months later, he called me and said, you know, Clancy, your drinking makes it impossible for you to work here, and so on. And I went through that year after year after year, gaining more children as I went along. And had a terrible time. I had some good years and some good bad years. Some years I made a lot of money because I could write well. But other years I'd be more concerned about my drinking. And I went through one spell in the 1950s where I got just the right amount of alcohol in me. I don't know what the hell caused it. I would go out and harass police officers. That's a stupid thing to do. Hey, do you know that you're a fascist son of a bitch? I started going to jail more rapidly then. But that's just disorderly conduct. So you get out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I got to go home and take a shower and go to work, you know. But I got one morning, one of my neighbors was standing there. He said, I won't come down to give you a ride home. I said, you shouldn't have come down here. That guy, I got his badge number. I'm going to get his ass. He really was abusive to me and hurt me a lot. He said, I don't know about that, but we were trying to reach you last night, wherever you might be drunk, because your little son died and we couldn't find you. And, oh, that just about killed me. Oh, in jail while your son dies. Jesus. And I, my wife and I took him up to Wisconsin, buried him in a little grave next to his grandmother, my wife's mother. And I took a bow in his casket. I said, John Emmisland, this will never happen again. This will never happen again. I'm so sorry. I'll make it up to you somehow. And I went back to Texas, and I quit drinking. I didn't go to AA. AA makes me want to drink. And I went to AA, and I didn't go to AA, stopped drinking, came home, had dinner with my family, with my kids. Hadn't done that for a while. And then we'd go for rides sometimes. I'd help with the schoolwork. Every little meal we'd say a prayer for baby John. It was all very touching. But one thing happened to me. One of the reasons I always knew I was not an alcoholic is that, unlike alcoholics, I can quit drinking whenever I want to. I've quit drinking many, many times. Whenever the limit of remorse gets high enough, I can stop drinking. And I could always stop drinking. My problem has never been that. My problem is, after I stop drinking, I'm doing okay. But somehow or other, we were talking about at the break, it's almost as though somebody puts an invisible spring in my gut. And in a couple of days, they start tightening it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It just comes out as, Jesus, this is a crappy place. Crappy people. Crappy family. Crappy neighbors. Crappy everything. I work for a crappy guy. It makes it kind of unpleasant. But you can do that for two or three days with that. And I tried all sorts of things. And one time I went to a psychiatrist in Milwaukee, and I spent a lot of money, and I took his pills, and I read his book, and he worked with me. But it didn't quite get rid of it. I still got it. And I discovered somewhere along the line, you know how to get rid of that feeling? Have a couple drinks. Oh, Jesus, that's good. Oh. Then you feel pretty good again. And if that were my problem, I would be home free. But my problem is, I don't seem to stop drinking when I feel good. I seem to keep going. And all of a sudden, it's 11:30 at night in the bar. I went in there at 5 for a minute. And now it's 11:30 and I'm drunk again. And somebody give me hell about my drinking. And my problem is not alcohol. My problem is how to stop before I get into trouble. You know, and all that crap. And I worked on that. I spent years just sitting, thinking to myself, playing little games with myself, how to do it. But my big problem is always going to a bar on the way home, just have a couple drinks, drink one drink, feel better, drink another drink, and that says, let's party. And at 11:30, I think, oh, damn it, I'm late again. And so I'm always trying to find that solution. And but I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were, but my problem is not alcohol. My problem is, I've thought about this a lot, is my emotions. I feel things too intensely. It's almost as though I should have a layer of something over me that isn't over there, over me. And I feel things too much, and I can see when people are screwing me around, and I can see how crappy they really are, and on and on. And it makes me upset. I want things to be nice. I don't want to be with crappy people in crappy situations. I don't want to get lost trying to find this place. And so I went to AA off and on. And AA, I thought, would maybe might help me because they talked good on it. But AA turned out to be a place where people said, I no longer have anger. I no longer have rage. I found a loving God. And that's all I need. some dear like me think, well, screw you. What do you know? I'm not an alcoholic. I can't return to God. It seems to me that's the two things you have to do in AA. Quit drinking and return to God and become wonderful. And I can't do that. I am naturally not geared for that. And so I went to AA over these years between jobs. I had to scramble for a job all the time because I had all those kids. And I hear people talk sometimes and they say, well, I just took a year off and drank that whole year. You won't do that if you get a bunch of kids in your house saying, food, food, food. You scramble. And I did that. And I did all right. And then when my little boy died, I really made an effort to quit drinking. And I did not quit. I could not quit really, but I tried to quit. And when I was working in Texas, and I quit and tried to be, and everything was fine. We said a little prayer for baby John every meal, and I was home every night. And then, as it had to happen, I guess, somebody snuck into my bedroom one night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And when I got up in the morning, I was nervous again. Not, didn't want to drink, just, Jesus, how did I get in this situation? And but I thought, I can get through this for baby John. But the next day it was even worse. I was very tense. And by Friday, I was just crazy. I needed something to take the heat off me. I didn't know what to do. And I got up in the morning, I just, damn it, I feel terrible. And I said, I'll go out and get some coffee. That's what I need. Went to the kitchen. There was no coffee. Little note there from my wife saying, I've taken the girls to church. Yeah, that's great. When I need a cup of coffee, you're in that damn church. Well, screw you. And I went out the garage, and I was just crazy. I took a hose and ran it from the exhaust pipe into the car and turned on the motor and went to sleep and died. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And apparently my neighbor was sitting in his breakfast nook watching me do this. And I didn't come out of the car, so he ambled over there and found me dead in the car. And they pulled me out and they beat on my chest. They rushed me to the hospital and worked on me for a couple days. And then they decided that I seemed to have some emotional problems, they felt. So they examined me and determined I was emotionally unstable and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period. Now that is a bit of an overkill, I think. I went to this, I'll tell you, small town nut houses are bad places. They're always made of bricks and just have some bad attendance. I remember the first night I was in the Big Spring State Hospital, just got to sleep, almost just get to sleep. And I heard somewhere around me, ha! Oh, shit. But eventually you get used to the evening scream, and then you... And I'd been in the nut house for a while. They noticed on my resume that in El Paso, I had been on the faculty of the University of Texas at El Paso staging a grand opera called El Mephistopheles. And so on that basis, they allowed me to direct a Christmas pageant in the nut house. And not very complex, just trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary as much as you could. And later that year, the next summer, I was getting restless. I wanted to get out of there. I didn't know how am I ever going to get out of here. Because every time I got restless, they'd give me some more check marks. He's restless again. And at that time, Texas did something that I didn't ever dream of until I heard about it later. They made a new law that whoever put you in the nut house, whoever signed your commitment papers, they could get you out if they agreed to be your supervisor, to take responsibility for you. And I heard that, and I kind of started writing the most wonderful letters to my wife. Oh, honey, I've learned my lesson. I have to be near you to live. It's on and on. And finally, she came down and got me out. Then I got a job in Dallas at this big advertising agency, Tracy Locke, where none of you are old enough to remember Elsie Nelmer, the Borden Cows, I don't imagine. A couple of old guys back there remember those. But I wrote those ads and was very, very successful. And they called me in one day and said, you know, Clancy, you really write well. Thank you very much. But we had the head chairman of the Freedom Corporation visit our business lately, yesterday. And we took him through the meetings. And we went to your office and you were drunk. And you talked rudely to him. And he was very upset because he's a religious man. And we promised him that we would fire you and try to see that you never worked again. I thought, God, what a craphead you are. He said, so I want you to be out of your office at 5 o'clock tonight, clean it out, and go home. I called your home and told your wife what you were going to do. Called her yesterday. I thought, that's really crappy. So she gets a running start on me. And he said, I'm giving you a very, very big severance check because we appreciate what you did for us, but we can't have you here. And I went down, I cleaned out my office, and went down to got a little room in a motel and made some new friends with my new money, and we drank and had parties and fun. Then I ran out of money, and I had to go home. A couple of days later, I didn't want to go home and hear that same old drivel. But I got home, and there was nobody there. Nobody home, no furniture, no nothing. All my clothes in a pile on the floor, porch, saying, we can't take anymore, we're leaving. Now, isn't that just like them? Make one mistake, and they turn on you. But I figured she probably turned me in. She probably turned me in. And so I had to get out of that state. And I knew a guy that had a car that he wanted delivered to Los Angeles. So I said, I'll do it. And the first day I got as far as El Paso, where I had a lot of friends, found a good way to hide my car, went to Juarez, where I'm a living legend. By midnight, I was standing on the bar of the Chinese Palace, once again more, saying, yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. And my fans were saying, cabrón, cabrón. I thought that meant welcome. And the next day, I got to Phoenix. I got to jam with somebody in the Mondom Phoenix jail all night long. Woke up in the morning so sick and got out of there. Terrible. And I got to Los Angeles finally, where I didn't know a soul. And one thing I learned in the years of slipping, there's one, if you're a slipper and you have no place to go, there's one place you're always welcome. An AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. Welcome, welcome. So I went to a club and I got in and I had no money. And the manager of the club said, you can't hang around here unless you're a member. I'm going to let you do it because you're going to die in our parking lot, I suppose. But you can go in the club with three rules. You can't ask anyone for money, which you've already done. None of your smart aleck, sarcastic remarks. And you have to go to a meeting every night. I was meeting one night in that club. A woman brought in a big tray of chocolate cake slices. I had about 4 pounds of that so I could build up my strength. And I went every night and I thought, God, I can't stand this. This is cruel and unusual punishment. Listen to these idiots talk. But I stuck around. The manager says, you can come in here, but you under those rules. And on Friday, I saw a guy in the meeting I'd seen in the movies. I thought, oh, actor with money. I bet he'd like to have a new friend. And I had no teeth in it. I gave my gum smile. And it turned out that he didn't want a new friend, but over a period of time, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he saved my life. And he did certain things for me. He showed me I was an alcoholic. And he showed me that I don't have to return to God in AA. And that there's a way to go here. And if you're new today, let me tell you. I know we're running a little bit late, but I might as well tell you anyway. How could I be an alcoholic? I remember telling him, I said, Bob, I told you about these emotions and these feelings. What do you think my problem is? He says, I think you're an alcoholic. I said, how could I be an alcoholic when my problem isn't really alcohol? It's a lot of other things. He said, kid, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. If it's your answer, you're stuck with that for the rest of your life. And I thought about that later. I've always been able to quit, but I always have to start again when things get so crappy. And I said, but I can't return to God. He said, you don't have to return to God. He said, why don't you read the steps once in a while on the wall? Step two says, came to believe. From wherever you are, you're coming to believe in something. Can't you believe in a power greater than yourself? I said, I don't think so. He said, can't you believe in a loving God? I said, no. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are? Of course you are. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could believe in that because I knew he was trying to help me. And he gradually took me through the steps. And much to my surprise, I was eventually stayed sober. And I held a job, finally, crappy little job, busboy. But I held a job, and when I was 3 years sober, guy gave me some juice into a big medical corporation. And when there was a beginning writer, and 2 years later, I was director of advertising for the whole corporation. And by the time I was 5 years sober, my same wife and children, oh, they heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Texas. Leaped out of their post office box and came to my side. Attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. But somebody gave me a book on the rhythm system, and I memorized that baby, I'll tell you. But when I was 15 years sober, I look back, I remember thinking about the first day I got, last day I got sober, last day I drank. I'd been thrown out of the midnight mission and Skid Row mission. Two guys threw me out on the sidewalk and said, don't come back. I said, you dirty bastard. But here I was now as a publicist for Big Beverly Hills firm. Had another little boy growing up. Had my family. But I just didn't feel right. I have a big house out in the west side. And my kids were doing well. You know, some of them were in college already. And my sponsor had died. I had a new sponsor named Chuck Chamberlain. And I went to him. I said, I don't know what the hell's wrong with me. But I got everything anybody should have to be happy. But I don't feel good. He said, I know your story, boy. He said, you went down awfully quick. And you came back up awfully quick. And I think you just feel you don't deserve it. I don't think that's it. But I started to watch out for things I could do to feel like I deserved it. So once I found myself going down to fill in briefly at the Midnight Mission, that terrible place. And I hung out in there, and I really got to like it. And I told my wife, I said, I think I might take that job. She said, they pay, what, $5,000 a year? And you're making $100,000 a year? You think a little bit of a chop off? And I said, yeah, but I can do it. So I went down there and I told them I'd run the Midnight Mission for 6 months until they found somebody. And then my savings would be gone. But tomorrow morning, I go back there. I've been there for 42 years now, waiting for something good to happen. But, you know, I don't want you to misunderstand me. If you're new, we don't think your happiness is based on getting a job and a mission. There's only so many missions got going around, and I got mine. And but I'll go to work tomorrow and watch people die from alcoholism and thrust themselves down in sidewalks in convulsion and watch their heads smashed up and on and on. I've been watching that for a lot of years. And my kids are all doing well. I live in a home, big house still out in the west side. My wife died suddenly a couple years ago. Most of you know Bob Durrell. Bob Durrell and I were speaking that weekend together in Massachusetts. And he was speaking on the 10th step, that we have to do more than just say, I'm sorry. You have to really do something about it. And on the way home, I thought, that's really true. I've said I'm sorry many times to my wife, but I really should do more. And I got home and she was sleeping. But I wrote a thing, put it on the kitchen table, where I took the blame for various things I've been trying to disguise for years. And I thought, well, she'll see that. I got up in the morning, she's still sleeping, so I went to work. I got to work and my daughter called me. She said, hurry home, mother just died. And I hurried home and she was, apparently she'd been sitting holding this paper and laughing and having a cup of coffee, took a sip of coffee and shut her eyes, never opened them again. I thought, what a wonderful way to go. And I'm so glad I wrote that letter because it took all the heat off me. But it really does, really does. I mean, I don't mean that in a good sense. I mean that instead of having said nothing, I should have done that. I did do it, which was a good thing. And so here I am now. I've been sober a long time. This year I have to go to Jerusalem and to Australia and to South America to talk about things that we talk about meeting. You think A would be different in those places, but it's not. Except for the accents, you hear the same crap you hear in your home group. They looked at me funny at work today. But the great thing about A is this. I've gone through the steps 3 or 4 times. The last time I went through them, I got hung up on the 9th step, or 11th step. And I suddenly realized, it says, not praying for things, but praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. So every night when I go to sleep, last thing I do, I pray for knowledge of God's will for me. I don't know what it is. I envy people who think they have it. I don't think anyone has it. Chuck Chamberlain didn't have it. Bill Wilson didn't have it. But somebody, people think they do have it. But I'll tell you, I find myself living comfortably in the world. And I'm making more money than I made when I started the mission, but I can pay for myself. And I have a daughter, you know. My daughter just retired as head of the biology department at the University of New Mexico, and her sisters prevailed upon her to come home and be my housekeeper. So I come home now and smell food instead of dogs. That's good. But I've been here to talk many times, and I try to finish with something clever that you think was cute. But I'm not going to say that this time. I'm going to say something different than I've been saying recently. I hope that this Christmas, if I get a gift, that you get a gift. I hope that God will teach us what to do and then give us a blessing, every one of us. Thank you.